Hello and welcome to the Martian Driving Podcast 111. My name is Terry Frost, and this time around I'm kind of winging it a little bit. I had some plans to do a couple of movies, but I looked at the movies and I thought, nah, I really can't get into it. I can't put together a podcast based on those two movies, which kind of put me behind the eight ball. So what I'm going to do is wing it and kind of do an overview of things I recommend. Now, some of these I've done before in the podcast, some I haven't, but just science fiction, fantasy, and horror films that I really recommend and that should be on your list to see if you haven't seen them, or your list to revisit if you have already seen them. So grab a biscuit, I'll get the contact details out of the way, and we'll get the show started. The Martian Drive-In Podcast appears every 2 weeks. It's a podcast of science fiction, horror, and fantasy movie appreciation, and sometimes television. It doesn't matter if it's old or new, good or bad, black or white or colour. As long as I like it, it may show up here. There are also occasional roundtables where I get together a group of like-minded people and we discuss a particular topic of interest to genre film nerds. You can support the podcast by donating at patreon.com/paleocinema. You can keep up with podcast news at the Paleo Cinema Cafe on Facebook. You can leave reviews on iTunes and send MP3 or written feedback to cultguru@gmail.com. That's cult with a K. This podcast may contain adult discussion, so don't listen to it in the car while driving the kids to school. Hey, how are you all doing? We're fine here. Next weekend, I'm recording a live Martian Drive-In podcast, which of course will be delivered to you after it's live, but I'll be doing it in front of an audience at Continuum 13, the National Science Fiction Convention, where Paul Polton and Narelle Harris and I will be discussing Wonder Woman, the movie I saw yesterday at the posh Gold Class Cinema with Sally, and we enjoyed it. I'm not going to kind of take the oxygen out of reviewing Wonder Woman. We're going to talk about a lot of things with it, and I thought because Narelle is a lot of fun on podcasts, I'll get her on. I'll get Paul on because I promised him he would be on the next pre-recorded Martian Drive-In podcast at a convention, and he's also pretty good at it as well. So we're recording that. It's only going to be 55 minutes we've got the room for, 55 to 60 minutes. So I will try to pad it out with a little something else to bring the podcast up to a reasonable length. But I'm looking forward to that. You get a different energy in front of a live audience, and you get that kind of random input factor happening, which I don't think is a bad thing. We can work with it, and of course you've got the option of editing it out if anything untoward happens. Nonetheless, it's going to be a bit of fun, and we're going to do it. I'll record it with my handy-dandy portable mic, and I should have it out in about 2 weeks. So what have I been watching? Well, lying on the couch, recovering from the gym, and I go to the gym 3 times a week now. I do about half an hour on the treadmill at a speed that won't kill me. And then I do some weights. I'm increasing the weights gradually. I'm trying not to build muscle bulk, but kind of burn fat. And so we'll see how that goes. I may at some stage get a trainer to show me through things, but at the moment, I want to get my cardio going nicely. I want to get the weights started so they don't intimidate me. And, it's going pretty well. On weekends, I do it about 6 o'clock in the morning on a Saturday and Sunday. I know that sounds like an abomination to a lot of people, mostly those who are hungover at that time of day. But for me, it works. The gym's pretty empty. I can go down there, take my time, do what I have to do, stand in front of the television that doesn't have a Hillsong channel on it, and just do what I need to do, listening to either podcasts or retro music. And I've been doing it for about 2.5-3 weeks now, and it seems to be working for me. I'm a lot better. My wind's a lot better. I'm feeling okay. And, you know, you've got to look after yourself. And that's one of the things, physically at least, I've been neglecting. So I'm back on track with that, and it should all be fun. So what have I been watching? The only things I've really watched since the last Paleo Cinema podcast I recorded are, I watched the Amicus film, The Land That Time Forgot, which has Doug McClure and Susan Penhaligon in it. It's an Edgar Rice Burroughs one about a lost continent full of dinosaurs and a very unusual way of evolution about it. All of the big dinosaurs, of course, are puppets, and it's fairly obvious that they are. But Doug McClure does a decent job as an action hero. The script, interestingly enough, the script was written by James Cawthorn and a very well-known and well-regarded science fiction writer, Michael Moorcock, which makes it a little more interesting than it would be otherwise. And had there been the special effects budget and, of course, the special effects technology to do the story justice, it would have worked a lot better. And I think, though, it's probably not going to be remade anytime soon after the debacle of the John Carter thing and the Tarzan movie. I think Edgar Rice Burroughs' projects aren't going to be touched for a while by large movie makers. There may be some smaller ones because a lot of that stuff is starting to fall into the public domain. But the larger stuff, you probably won't see too much of Rice Burroughs' adaptation happening, at least for the next number of years. I also, as I said, watched Wonder Woman. It was pretty good, actually, because in the posh cinema, the Gold Class, you can order food and have it delivered during the movie, which is kind of cool. And so I got a pulled pork slider plate delivered, which was very nice. So that's all I'll say about that. I did see the Dan Brown adaptation, the third one that Tom Hanks has been a part of, called Inferno, which stars Felicity Jones and a bunch of other people, and it's not very good. It really kind of, the start of it's confusing, both to the protagonist and to the audience. Some lovely locations, the usual puzzles that he's got to figure out, and all that kind of thing. A nice international cast. The cast is beautifully international and multiracial, and shows how you can do these things right. But the movie itself just doesn't work for me. I know it had a lower budget than the previous ones. It was, as the previous two were, directed by Ron Howard. But, I don't think it particularly works. The only other thing I've watched is one of the movies that I was going to do for the podcast, and which I found a bit boring and dull and really not engaging enough for me to run an episode on, and that was Dracula's Daughter, the 1936 Universal sequel to Dracula, starring Gloria Holden. Even though it's got that little moment of lesbian frisson in it, it really is a kind of what-the-fuck kind of movie, and I've said before, I don't know if I said it in Martian or whether I said it in Paleo. These days I'm trying not to do movies that don't grab me. The movies I do may be things that aren't very good, but I find something intriguing about and I can have a lot of fun with, and I can see where they work and where they don't work. But there's got to be that kind of engagement for me. And I really didn't find it with Dracula's Daughter. I wanted to like it more than I did. I'd seen it a number of years ago, but it just didn't work. I don't think it had... it wasn't a good sequel to Dracula, let's be honest with you. And I really, even though there are a lot of people who like it and a lot of people who are very erudite and knowledgeable supporters of it, for me it just didn't work. And so I kind of went to one side and went, no, I'm not going to do that movie, even though Universal's horror franchise has just been rebooted with The Mummy, which I am seeing. I've got enough points on my Village card, which is the cinema complex I go to be able to see a movie for free and to get some popcorn as well. So I'm going to use those points to see The Mummy probably sometime in the next week or two, and I'll podcast about that if I like it. Nonetheless, I'm a little disappointed that Dracula's Daughter didn't engage me the way I wanted it to, but these things do happen, so we kind of roll with them and move along from there. So that's about it for what I've been watching. So here's what I'm going to do. I'm just going to kind of freewheel it and kind of just ramble around my mind as far as science fiction, horror, and fantasy movies are concerned. And I was kind of getting a bit reflective on when I saw Zombies of Muratau, which I have spoken about on a recent podcast, that being the very first zombie movie I ever saw. One of the things that made me reflect is how our minds evolve over time on what we find horrible and what we find kind of transgressive and scary in a movie. It's been a while since I've been scared by a movie. Maybe I got jaded, maybe I got smarter, maybe I got older, maybe movies aren't as scary in some ways than they used to be. But something like Zombies of Muratau really did scare me as a child because the idea of people coming back from the dead and being nasty to you, I was already quite familiar with violence as a concept and as a physical and emotional reality. So maybe that kind of helped a bit. But nonetheless, the way I perceive horror movies, and I'll start with horror, then we'll go into science fiction and fantasy. But the way I perceive horror movies has very much changed over the years. There are horror movies that I really don't like. For instance, I consider something like the recent TV series Handmaid's Tale to be a horror story, even though it is science fiction, and it's a what-if-this-continues kind of speculative future. I find it a horror story, and I find it, I can't watch it. And I've kind of tried to figure out why, which is, you know, if you suddenly have an instinctive reaction to something, it's useful to analyze it. And men abusing women is something that's deeply part of my past, because I saw my father beat up and assault my mother in various ways when I was a young child. And so the very concept of men systematically and across a whole nation treating women like property and doing monstrous things to them is something that I have a visceral reaction to. And so Handmaid's Tale isn't something I'm going to be watching for that reason. I understand that it's very, very good. I understand that it does some important things. I understand that it should be told, and that Margaret Atwood's original book is an incredibly useful piece of science fiction. But for me, I'm not going there. And, you know, again, there are a number of people who don't go to popular media for a number of reasons. It's just one of those things where, for me, it goes into a dark and horrible area that I really don't want to visit, given the fact that we only have so many hours in the day to consume entertainment. And even though I'm not going to necessarily go for fluffy bunnies and Dora the Explorer all the time, in fact, I've only seen one episode of Dora the Explorer, and that's when I was at the gym today. You'll be glad to know that the howler monkey went to the doctor and got its sore throat seen to. But leaving that aside, I really wanted to see things that, even if they are challenging and nasty and nightmarish at times, and in that sense, not entertaining but confronting. I'm fine to go there with certain things, but there are other things that I really can't go to, and Handmaid's Tale is definitely one of those. So these days, the things that horrify me, the way that Zombies of Moira Tower did, the way that Psycho did when I first saw it in the cinema, there was a repeat screening in the late 1960s or early 1970s that I went to in the cinema, and Psycho scared me there. In a darkened room full of other people, it's a different experience than sitting comfortably in your lounge room with the lights on, believe me. But, so the things that horrify us move around, and don't expect the stuff that was scary to you when you were a kid to be scary to you now, because chances are that that's shifted in some way based on your life experience and based on your, hopefully, your increased wisdom and knowledge as time goes on. So that's horror. Now, science fiction is different for me. The science fiction I watched as a kid that I can still enjoy now, to a certain extent. I mean, I enjoyed when I was a kid watching things like Lost in Space. But watching episodes of Lost in Space now, it seems all a bit cardboardy and obvious. And you think, well, they had an opportunity there with that script to go in a really interesting science fiction direction. And instead, they went with a kiddie obvious, and they kind of didn't even try to do the things that they clearly knew they were heading toward. And yeah, there are a number of things where basically you got a family and friends and a monstrously horrible person traveling around randomly in space. The dramatic possibilities are endless, and the Lost in Space movie from a decade or so ago really didn't go there in any interesting way. But there weren't lost opportunities, and it wasn't that they didn't know, because you got to remember, this is after Twilight Zone came out. This is after The Outer Limits came out. So good visceral science fiction was there. But they also made the mistake of, because it was, in a sense, a kid's show, they really didn't want to go with interesting speculation, not necessarily in a dark and nasty kind of way, but in an interesting and kind of useful way. And so they didn't ever, with one or two exceptions in a couple of episodes which almost play like fairy tales, the one with Michael J. Pollard, for instance, being a very good example of that, and Warren Oates playing a space cowboy, you kind of got to give them those sort of things. But for the most part, Lost in Space, for me, watching a couple of episodes now, is shit they went obvious, shit they went vanilla, and even by the standards of the time, they dumbed it down way too much, even for a children's show. But then there were other things that I saw, and particularly in the cinema, like Forbidden Planet and This Island Earth and Creature from the Black Lagoon, which is kind of science fiction more than it is horror in some ways. And I did see them at the cinema. And they really work well, and they still maintain that to this day. This Island Earth, perhaps a little bit less than Forbidden Planet and Creature from the Black Lagoon. But nonetheless, there's something that, for me, hasn't dated. And they definitely hold their own as far as being science fiction is concerned. And again, you've got to kind of go into, okay, why is that the case? And I think it is that they didn't necessarily take it seriously all the time, but they treated the genre with respect. They respected this as a means of storytelling. In some cases, this as a means of reflecting on current times. And that's the thing to remember, too, that even something like, and I won't get there because I'll save it for the Wonder Woman episode, but even things which are set in another time and are supposed to be of another time, in a lot of ways, they're talking about now, here and now. And that's kind of cool, using the mirror of the past to reflect certain things about the present is an old trope in science fiction and, of course, in other forms of genre as well, but in particularly in science fiction. But apart from that, they respected the genre. They respected it as a medium for telling stories in the same way that people who didn't just do programmer westerns respected that genre as a way of telling stories. Things like High Noon is about the McCarthy era in a certain way. And Rio Bravo is about individuals doing the right thing, even if the price is high. And The Magnificent Seven is about the strong defending the weak. And, you know, there are all these things where genres can tell us morality tales in some ways, but also can make a comment and open up a dialogue about certain tropes and certain things about this moment in history. And that kind of works really nicely for me. I mean, even the remake of The Magnificent Seven, for instance, was about corporate greed in some ways. And that was okay. It wasn't done very well, but still that was the basis of the whole conflict dynamic and how it affects normal people. So that was at least attempted in that movie, but not particularly well. And even science fiction, I mean, one of the other good things about science fiction that I learned as a child is that science fiction movies can be a fun ride. My vulgar pleasure of the 21st century is The Core, which I've spoken about on a previous Martian Driving podcast. It's not good science, but it's really good action science fiction. It harks back to movies like Cracking the World and a whole bunch of other ones where a team of scientists get together and science the fuck out of shit to save the world, even though the science was ropey. They tried to show us things we hadn't seen before and go places we hadn't seen before. They got good character actors involved to play the roles, and it was a lot of fun and highly entertaining. And again, that's the one thing that Marvel has done really well and led the way with in the superhero franchise, getting good actors in and tailoring to a certain extent the scripts and the characters to the strengths of those particular actors. And that makes sense a lot. I think it's something that DC has learnt later than Marvel ever did. And it's something that's probably going to be brought into both the monster franchise, the one with Godzilla and King Kong in it, and the reboot of the Universal Horror Monster franchise, starting with The Mummy, where you've rolled people like Dr. Jekyll into it in an interesting way. And maybe that'll work, as long as you don't make the mistake, which Marvel has avoided thus far, of making the stars the point of the movie. Now, having Tom Cruise starring in The Mummy may or may not be a misstep, because the focus is on Tom Cruise then, instead of the monster. And I think that's a bit like doing a 1930s Dracula with the emphasis being on Van Helsing rather than Dracula. You really can't go there. Now, I could be entirely wrong. I don't know too much about the movie apart from the fact that Rusty Crowe is playing Dr. Jekyll, which is a kind of good choice, because he can play gentle and compassionate and play bugfuck crazy angry. So, yeah, for that dynamic, he's a good choice. But really, you've got to kind of keep the stars in the same perspective and at the same size. And I'm deliberately using that word when I speak about Tom Cruise as the monster, because the monster is what the movie, in the same sense that the superpowers and the superhero are the movie. And the actors are very important. And yeah, you know, Robert Downey Jr. at the time he did Iron Man in 2008 was a punchline to late night comedy jokes. But he did have a certain persona, he did have a certain cockiness, he did have a certain ability to act the fuck out of any role he's ever given. And so that worked. But I'm not convinced that Tom Cruise isn't cash checking to make a lot of money. He does see himself as a superhero. He's a fucking top-level Scientologist. He thinks he's halfway to being Jesus Christ anyway. But nonetheless, we'll see what happens with the franchise, because they've really got to be careful with that, not to have the actor make it top heavy. And of course there will be a lot of Tom Cruise running, because ever since he made Born on the 4th of July, he's been trying to compensate for playing a guy in a wheelchair, and every movie he does he runs, because you know he's an aging guy, and I think there's a certain machismo about staying in the game for him. It's really odd. I mean, I have this kind of cognitive dissonance with Tom Cruise movies, wherein I like Tom Cruise movies, but I never particularly like Tom Cruise or the roles he plays. Now, I don't know how that came about and by what magic that occurs, but it's the case, and it really is kind of fucking weird. But anyway, to just go back to what I was saying, science fiction is really interesting, and the difference between that for me and horror is that the things that were scary for me, the things that engage me with science fiction at the time I was young, are still the same things that engage me now, whereas the things that engage me in horror fiction have changed significantly. And maybe that's the nature of me coming to terms with some traumas in my past and seeing them in a different perspective. And horror being kind of central to that, and fear and loathing and apprehension all being wrapped into that. It makes it a much more complex cocktail for me psychologically than science fiction does, where science fiction was always me looking, I mean, I want to see more utopian science fiction futures where problems occur, but people have become wiser. That's one of the reasons why Star Trek was always such a good franchise. And who knows, maybe Star Trek Discovery will continue that, maybe not. I know there are some problems with the production of that TV series, but being basically a utopianist by nature, I'm looking forward to it. So that then brings us to fantasy films. And fantasy films for me have kind of come down to some fairly narrow stuff. I really like, at the time, and I know this is cultural appropriation, and I'll kind of foreshadow my comments by saying, yes, I realize that this stuff is cultural appropriation. It's pinching other people's cultures and adapting them, probably thanks to Richard Francis Burton, the explorer who translated the Arabian Nights tales into English, and then his wife cut out all the really kind of sexy ones. But Arabian Nights stories were the stuff that I liked. 1001 Nights with Cornel Wilde and Phil Silvers, where he's playing a thief in Baghdad who ends up being a prince and that kind of thing. Kind of rehashing the classic Thief of Baghdad, both the 1925 Douglas Fairbanks version and the Michael Powell, Sabu, John Justin version from 1940. I kind of like that too, because I like the anachronisms, and I like the fact that Phil Silvers is playing a hep cat in Baghdad in like Middle Ages kind of thing. The fact that they reference Sinatra in it, it's a very funny movie. You can find a copy of 1001 Nights with Cornel Wilde and Phil Silvers and Evelyn Keyes in it. It's a lot of fun to watch, and even though it's 1940s and it has a lot of 1940s references, it really is kind of cool. So they're the kind of fantasy films that I watched, Thief of Baghdad, 1001 Nights, Arabian Nights with John Hall and Maria Montez, with those beautifully saturated Technicolor hues. In fact, I just haven't put it on the list yet, but I just rewatched one of their other movies that Sabu did with Maria Montez and John Hall, and that's a movie called Cobra Woman, which has got the most fantastic, eye-poppingly brilliant Technicolor, and some fantastic set designs, and a very phallic dance with a cobra. In fact, it was Kenneth Anger's favourite movie. Just those kind of, you know, the 1940s, the programmers in a sense, they weren't the best movies made in the era. They were purely entertainment. They were purely silly. They were South Sea Island adventures in the case of Cobra Woman. But I kind of like that kind of fantasy, and it's very much the stuff I saw when I was a kid. There were other movies with genies and magic, and of course I Dream of Jeannie came along when I was a kid, and I fell in love with Barbara Eden, and every little girl I knew at the time wanted to be Barbara Eden because they could do magic and they could make boys look silly. And yeah, there was a kind of, even though it was all that master and slave kind of shit, there was a kind of empowerment, in the same way that Samantha in Bewitched was empowered to a certain extent within those fucking horrible 1960s television genre roles. But that kind of stuff I liked as well. Anything to do with magic was kind of fun. Then there was illusionists as well. There was stuff like in 1973, the TV series The Magician with Bill Bixby, where he plays an illusionist to solve crimes and things. So you got that kind of magic as well. And a TV series from back in the day, which was in syndication here in Australia, which was about a family of magicians, in fact, you know, real-life illusionists, The Magical World of Alakazam, which was on TV a lot, and they'd do things like sawing people in half in little miniature trains and doing all sorts of other illusions, which I know how to do them now. And there's only a little bit of this stuff on YouTube, which is a bit of a shame, because it was really fun, and it, even though you knew it was a trick, and even as a kid you know things are tricks, you just don't know how it's done. And while you're a kid, you've also got that sneaking suspicion that there's some kind of hidden knowledge there, and that they have tapped into something really magical. So you've got that suspension of disbelief as a child, while still knowing that in some ways it's a trick, the same way as when an uncle does a trick with a coin and pulls it from behind your ear, or does a card trick. You know there's something, you don't know about it, but you know it's based in reality. But you got a suspicion that what if it isn't? Those kind of magic things were the things that I liked as a kid. And fantasy movies these days are more about, they're kind of like an adaptation of war movies in a sense. The Harry Potter thing is about a whole bunch of kids going to war. The Lord of the Rings thing is a reflection, of course, on Tolkien's experiences during World War I. And all those kind of big epic battles and the magic involved in those. But still, it's about war, it's about good versus evil. It's all that kind of simplistic stuff which doesn't have a lot of nuance to it. That's one of the virtues of the Harry Potter things, is characters like Snape have a wonderful complexity and ambiguity to them that make them really work. Of course, you've got Alan Rickman playing the character as well. But nonetheless, there's that kind of complexity to them, and the things aren't quite as simple as people make out. And again, that's a story that reflects something about our current times. There are two conflicting wars of ideology going on in the world at the moment. There's, of course, religion versus rationality, which is playing out a number of fields. And then you've also got the rich versus the poor, which is playing out again on some of those same battlefields, but a lot. And they all kind of cross over in a weird way in the recent presidential elections, with Republicans encouraging the worst nature of the electorate and electing Trump, which of course then rolls on and has its own problems. And we're in deeply speculative territory. We're in, as I've said on social media, we're on that, you know how you have a turning point in time travel story, where if one thing happens, the world's okay, and if the other thing happens, it doesn't. We're in the other one, where the other thing happened, and we're living kind of dystopian. One of the things I was going to put up on social media, but I haven't yet, is, do you think we're living in a dystopia yet, or are we on the brink of it? And that's an important question as well. And again, it rolls back into speculative fiction, that utopia, dystopia paradigm. Are we in a we're clearly not in a utopia unless we're very, very wealthy, and that's a very small number of people. And even then, it's fairly complex. But are we yet in a dystopia? I know a number of people in the world are, particularly, just to use a few examples off the top of my head, people working in Walmart in America, people living in various war zones, people who are living under the horrible restrictions of certain belief systems in places like Aceh province in Indonesia, Saudi Arabia, North Korea as well, all of those kind of places. People are living in dystopia. But is the planet in a dystopian situation just yet? Or is it about to be? Or can we avoid it? The world has got to be science fictional. And one of the things for traditional science fiction fans like myself is the fact that everybody knows science fiction now. Back when I was a kid, science fiction was a niche market for kids and nerds. And really, there wasn't a lot of money to be made in a science fiction film, particularly. Some of them did okay at the box office, but for the most part, they weren't really doing as well as westerns and spy movies were and all those other kind of genres, which were, in a sense, a lot more accessible to people. But now science fiction is ubiquitous. We're living in a science fiction world. We've got computers in our pockets, and we can talk to anybody who has a similar computer in their pocket anywhere on the planet. That's science fiction. We can, if we remember when people used to say, who was that guy in that movie? And you'd sit around trying to figure out which person they were talking about. These days, you just look it up on IMDb. But back in the day, people held a lot of that shit in their heads rather than in their hands. So we're in a science fiction world, and that's had an impact on science fiction as a genre. I'll give you an example, and this is a true story. 20 years ago, I think it was, or around 20 years ago, I was at a World Science Fiction Convention in Melbourne, and there was a short, fat guy sitting on a couch just reading a book. I knew him because he was a friend of a friend, and he was a very nice guy. His partner was a lovely lady, and I really enjoyed his work. That was a time 20 years ago when George R.R. Martin could sit on a chair in a lobby at a hotel in a science fiction convention and reading a book and be willing for a chat with people. Before Game of Thrones went blockbuster, before he started getting mentioned on late night television programs, before people suddenly went, fuck, this guy can write. He was a good science fiction writer, but a part of the science fiction community, which he still is, and he's given back to the community in any number of ways. But you go up and walk to me. The same thing happened in 1995 in Tasmania to me, where I could walk into the bar of a convention which had 150 members, and there in the bar are Kim Stanley Robinson and Neil Gaiman, and you can sit down and have a chat. It's science fiction has become big business at the moment. And very, very well-deserved fame, fortune, and celebrity has come to a number of people involved in it. 20 years ago, Joe Rowling was sitting in a cafe writing, scribbling a book in a notepad. Not explosion, but growth and kind of expansion of science fiction and fantasy and genre stuff, which is something that everybody wished for. Back when the day when people used to say science fiction is a ghetto, everybody was hanging out and wishing for science fiction to break out. And even though they all had, and this is true, at the time people had a lot of qualms about Star Wars, they embraced it because it was incredibly successful and they thought it would help science fiction and a lot of better science fiction to be made. Didn't happen for a long time. I'm not going to go into that again, but the reason it was embraced by the community wasn't the fact that they were seeing everything they'd seen in science fiction novels, up on the screen. It was the fact that the success of that work gave hope for better work to get some oxygen. And in some cases it did. For a long time you got Star Crash and Battlestar Galactica and shit like that. But eventually it happened, but it only happened after a very long time and a very lot of very bad movies. So science fiction has changed enormously. And there are some people who have some problems with that. There are people who are grumpy about it because their cozy little community suddenly has a whole bunch of people in there that want to dress up like Harley Quinn and all those other things. But yeah, I mean, suddenly it's a big thing, science fiction, because we can see the future. We're living in it. It's wrapped around us. It's not jetpacks and stuff, but it is iPhone 7s and Samsung Galaxy S8s. And it's the World Wide Web, and it's icebergs carving off Greenland and Antarctica. And it's having a guy who may or may not have Alzheimer's being president of the United States and drawing away from rationality, something which Robert Heinlein predicted 70 years ago. All of this kind of stuff is a part of our world, and genre works, and genre is the stuff that gave us the cautionary tales we now need and gave us the speculation that we're now seeing happen in real life. And even though very, very few science fiction stories predicted very much about the future, they did accurately predict the perils of our times and the stuff we needed to avoid and the stuff that would endanger us. An Australian science fiction writer, a guy in Melbourne who I knew, George Turner, wrote a book called Sea in Summer, which is about a Melbourne flooded by global warming, and he wrote it 25 years ago. Really good book, really interesting guy. He wrote a number of really great science fiction books. The first person I ever learned about good science fiction from was George Turner. I spent a week with him at a writer's workshop in 1979. And his book, The Sea in Summer, has now become a kind of text for global warming in a lot of ways. But science fiction has become something that even science fiction writers and science fiction readers never predicted. It's all around us. It comes through us like Wi-Fi signals pierce the walls of your house. We are science fiction, and we live in a science fiction world. And whether it ends up being a utopia or a dystopia is up to us. Individually, you can't fix the world. But I came up with an aphorism this week, which I think is kind of useful. Tell me if it is. Let me know what you think. Don't let monsters turn you into monsters. Now, that's a kind of cheap little line, but it's something I've evolved over time because we know vampires turn people into vampires in horror. We know, to our great dismay, that a number of people who are abused as children will go on to abuse as adults. So in that sense, monsters create monsters. And with the terrorism things, and there are reasons why people become terrorists. We can't just say they do it because they're evil, because their belief system's evil. Religion, I have problems with at the best of times, but I don't believe that mainstream Muslim people just suddenly decide to get in a van, travel to the middle of London, and start hacking people up. It's not about that. It's about mental illness. And the way we react to monsters is important, and we act to monstrous acts. So we can call people monsters if we like, and I use that just because it was a useful shorthand when I was making up that saying. But in reacting against terrorism, in reacting against Trump, and reacting against sexism and racism and every other dark ism that's out there, the thing we've got to do, and the thing that's almost the most important thing for us to do, is to not let their hatred and their violence make us hateful. And it's hard. It is hard. I mean, I know as well as a lot of people that hate what it feels like to hate a parent and to be justified down to the grass in that hatred of a parent, and to know what it's like to have somebody who should be looking after you bruise you and concuss you and split your head open with a belt buckle. I know all of that stuff. And for a lot of time, I let those monstrous acts turn me monstrous. I wasn't my best self, and I still am on the road to being my best self. But one of the things, probably the thing that if I could give to everybody in the world right now, apart from a decent living, free Wi-Fi, food, drink, and safety, is the idea that you don't let monsters make you become monsters. Because once you do, they win. They have the control, they have the influence, they turn your life in the direction that they wanted to turn your life. They make you become like them. They make you a monster. And that isn't what I want. And I'll give you one last example just to kind of typify where my head's at with that. I did see an article which provided strong evidence, and I don't know whether it's true or not, but it's evidence that's not unreasonable, that Donald Trump may be suffering from the front end of Alzheimer's. And that stopped me and made me think, because my mother is suffering from a different kind of dementia at the moment, so it's something with which I'm kind of familiar. And I decided that I was going to pull away from mocking Trump, because there's that possibility that what I'm mocking is somebody that's in an incredible mental decline. Horrible though his actions are, horrible though the man is, sexist, racist, nasty, dishonest about his own hair as the man is, I didn't want to be the person to do that kind of thing. And I'm kind of comfortable with that. A lot of other people kind of used that posting on social media as an excuse to keep the attack on Trump and to kind of punch harder, in a sense. But for me, I decided to walk away from it. Yeah, I'll criticize the actions, absolutely. There's no question of that. But you can't let monsters make you monsters. Even if it is something that a man with a cognitive decline, he was nasty before the cognitive decline, but nonetheless, I'm not comfortable with punching downwards in an intellectual sense and in a psychological sense. And so I've kind of stepped away from that. And it's not because I want to be an angel, because I am far from that. I'm nothing near that. But, you know, I've learned a bit from movies, and I've learned that monsters can turn you into monsters. And just to bring this back around to movies, I really don't want to be the person bitten in the neck who suddenly turns and bites the hero in the neck. I really don't want to be that. And I think that while staying strong, you can be compassionate even to your enemies and even to the people who wrong you and even to the people you hate. And that's kind of an interesting place to be. There are a number of genre works that kind of reflect that and take that approach. Good versus evil isn't something that I like as a dynamic. I think it's harmful to think in those terms, because it allows you to take immensely monstrous actions with the illusion that you're justified in taking them. So when you see good versus evil, simplistic stuff in movies and television and in books and comics and things like that, I don't know about you, but it's not the world that I see around me. I don't see that level of simplicity in the world. I see it as a complex place, and there are reasons why people take certain actions. I'll give you another example. If you look in the newspaper in Australia from late 1940s, there are talks of terrorist attacks there. There are terrorist attacks on hotels, on British hotels. There are terrorist attacks in a number of different places, in a number of ways, and people died, a lot of them. And the newspapers reported those terrorist attacks and speculated about what could be done about them. A year later, the State of Israel was formed after those attacks by Zionists. So the way we see people who are making these attacks changes over time. And even though I've got some problems with Israel's policy towards Palestine and things like that, the people we think are the bad guys aren't always the bad guys. They are misguided and cruel and desperate and influenced by people they respect that they shouldn't, and all sorts of shit like that. The world's a complex place. The world can't be kind of broken down into black and white. And I hate, with a passion, genre works these days that give us that simple dynamic, because I don't think it's right and I don't think it's fair and I don't think it's helpful to anybody to have that. Goodies versus baddies, which a recent Australian Prime Minister has used in a speech, is not the worldview of an adult. So anyway, I'm going to wrap this up, because I'm kind of drifting off science fiction here, bringing it around, but drifting off science fiction way too much. And as an Irishman once said to me, I got the words on me tonight. Yeah, you know, he said to me, you've got the words on you, haven't you? And I went, yes. And that means that you're on a rant and a roll and ideas are pouring out of you. And I've got a bit of that tonight. And I'm sorry if you were expecting me to talk about a couple of movies, but instead I've gone into a long philosophical dissertation about the nature of the universe. But I hope I brought it around to genre just that little bit. But anyway, next time around, we're back on track and we're going to be talking about Wonder Woman live at Continuum 13 over the Queen's Birthday long weekend, which is next weekend here in Australia. And I'm going to have a great time. Sal and I are there for 4 days. We've got hotel rooms. Sal's settling her crafts at Continuum, which is always fun for her. And I'm checking up with a lot of people, including some people I've had guesting on the podcast, some Alyssa and Tansy and Paul Poulton, Grant Watson, a number of other people have been on the podcast. I'm catching up with in Meat Space, and I should enjoy that. It's a gathering of the tribe for me, and that's kind of cool. But anyway, I've got an extra person to thank as well, because I did get a donation to help the podcasts directly into my PayPal account, which is a little bit of a surprise. And I did buy a copy, by the way, of the dance movie French Cancan using that particular piece of funding, because I saw a very bad online copy of French Cancan, but I wanted a decent one. It's a dance movie in three acts with Moira Shearer in it, Sid Charisse and Zizi Jeanmaire, and a new friend of the podcast, Nathaniel DeBell, popped a bit of money into the PayPal. So thank you very much for that, Nathaniel. I've got your most recent email and I'll put it into the next Paleo Cinema podcast, but I appreciate your support. Always happy to hip people to movies they're not aware of. I've got one I've really wanted to do a podcast about in Paleo Cinema that very few people know about and that I haven't even seen yet, but that addresses a really contemporary issue in the 1961 movie. And I haven't been able to track it down yet, but I will. But anyway, that's about it. Thank you to the two carriers as well for being Patreon subscribers. And as usual, the rest of the Patreon subscribers get their movie credits in the way of cinema credits right at the end of the podcast. So thank you for listening to my little verbiage and rant and rave and the rest of it. Look after yourselves. If you're up north, stay safe out of the sun. If you're down here, stay warm. If you're somewhere else, enjoy your life. Watch some good movies, watch some bad movies, watch movies you like, watch movies that challenge you, and keep watching the skies. And I'll be back soon with another Martian Driving podcast and with another Paleo Cinema podcast. And again, here are the credits. Take care of yourselves. Thank you to all of the Patreon subscribers, and here are the credits in the style of movie credits to acknowledge and thank all of them. We have Tom, our focus puller, Sarah, our special effects technician, Ian, our caterer, Grant, our technicolor consultant, Claire, our script doctor, Gary, our prop master, Morris, our music director, Jan, our dialect coach, Armin, our key grip, Matt, our rattlesnake wrangler, Elaine, our scientific advisor, Julia, our casting director, Chris, our camera operator, Christopher, our gaffer, Miss Jane, the wardrobe mistress, Tansy, the foley artist, Alyssa, the location scout, Mark, our second unit director, Paul, our special makeup effects director, Tammy, our donut wrangler, Tim, our New York unit director, Rabbi Steve, our spiritual advisor, Steve, our script doctor, Dylan, our goat wrangler, Eric, our set security lead, Kerry, our second script doctor, Richard, our set photographer, and our extras, Kathleen, Mark, and David. And let's not forget Steve Sullivan, our director of monster effects, and Richard C., our transportation co-captain. So thank you very much to all the subscribers, and you too can subscribe at patreon.com/paleocinema.